was after 9 o'clock. Scarlet Falls rolled up the streets and sidewalks at 8. The headlights were still there when she drove past the country road that led to her grandfather's house on the Scarlet River. Morgan dug her phone from her tote. She'd call her sister, Stella, a detective with the SFPD, and ask to meet her somewhere. The car behind her was probably a coincidence. Just someone headed in the same direction, but Morgan wasn't taking any chances. Not with Tyler on the loose. She was scrolling for her sister's number when the headlights disappeared. Morgan blew out a breath. You're paranoid. She turned the car around and went home. But as she climbed out of her minivan, a cold breeze wrapped around her. She shivered, the hairs on the back of her neck rising as if someone was watching. She scanned the grass and trees but saw no one. The front yard was lit up like the Meadowlands. There were no big shrubs to hide behind. The dogs were at the window barking. She jogged up the front steps and didn't take a deep breath until she was inside the house. Other than the dogs snuffling around her legs, the house was quiet. The girls would have gone to bed hours ago. Morgan closed and locked the door. Hey! Her sister Stella walked out of the kitchen. Stella scanned Morgan's face. What's wrong? Morgan told her about Tyler. I probably imagined feeling someone watching me. The news about Tyler being out of jail has me on edge. Snoozer, her French bulldog, begged for attention. But rescue dog Rocket brushed past Morgan's legs and went to the front window. Her white and tan markings and docked tail were bulldog-like, but the mutt's lean body was some other breed altogether. A low growl rumbled from her chest, and the fur on the back of the dog's neck rose. What is it, girl? Morgan knelt beside the dog and rested a hand on her back. The dog stiffened and barked. Morgan stroked her head. Stella pulled her cell phone from her pocket. The dog senses something. I'm going to have a patrol unit check the neighborhood. Morgan rubbed the dog's shoulder. Good girl. Climbing to her feet, she dumped her coat on a chair and went into the kitchen. Both dogs followed at her heels. Her grandfather sat in his wheelchair at the table, a glass of milk and a piece of banana bread on a plate in front of him. His broken leg was encased in a plaster cast and elevated. He was trying to work an unbent wire coat hanger into the top of the cast. The doctor said you shouldn't do that. Morgan took the hanger. You could scratch yourself and get an infection.
It itches.
Grandpa sulked. She bent down and kissed his cheek. I know. And I know you're bored out of your mind, too. 2 more weeks, then the cast comes off and you can put some weight on that leg. Her heart clenched when she thought about how they'd almost lost him during surgery.
I'll get through it.
He reached up and patted her arm.
What was up with the dog?
Morgan repeated her story about Tyler and the car as she opened the fridge and poured a glass of milk. I'm glad Rocket's here. The alarm system will tell us if someone's breaking into the house. But that dog will let us know if someone is outside, thinking about breaking into the house. Grandpa tossed the dog a piece of banana bread. She caught it in the air, her big jaws snapping like an alligator's. Grandpa frowned.
Damn this leg. I'm not as useful as I could be.
Morgan smiled. A retired NYPD detective, Grandpa had broken his leg protecting her and her daughter. You did just fine.
Tell me about the rest of your day.
Morgan started with her afternoon at the courthouse with Eric and moved on to the scene at Gray Lake.
So, you trumped the new ADA, showed up Bryce Walters. Again, and rattled the sheriff out for coercing confessions from suspects.
Yes. Morgan sipped her milk, suddenly wishing it was wine. It's been a full day.
Nice way to make friends and influence people.
Grandpa shook his head.
How's Lance?
I don't know. Morgan checked her phone. He's with his mother now.
That has to be rough.
Yes. And he hadn't called her. Stella appeared in the doorway. The patrol unit didn't find anything. They're going to do another drive-by later tonight. Thanks, Morgan said. I could stay, Stella offered. You were here all day. Go home to Mac. We have the alarm, the dog, and I'll break out my handgun tonight. But as sexist as it felt, Morgan wished Lance was there. Okay. Stella took her keys from her pocket. Mac doesn't teach any classes tomorrow. He'll be here at 8 to help Grandpa get washed and dressed. Morgan took the dogs out with her to walk Stella to her car. The dogs did their business while she watched her sister get into her car and drive away. A police car cruised past and she went inside. She checked the windows and doors and set the alarm before walking back to her bedroom and opening her gun safe. She took her Glock out and set it high on her armoire. Then she brushed her teeth, put on her pajamas, and prepared to not sleep. Once again, her family was in danger. Chapter 6. Lance hesitated, his key an inch from the lock on his mother's door. Once he went inside, there was no going back. No taking back the words he would need to say. No resetting his mother's recovery train on its rails. But he didn't have a choice. He unlocked and opened the door. "Lance? Is that you?" his mother called from the back of the house. He made his way through the tidy house, back to her office. His mom had succumbed to anxiety, depression, and hoarding after her husband's disappearance. At one point in Lance's youth, clutter had filled the house, leaving them narrow pathways to move from room to room. She sat behind her L-shaped desk. A former computer science professor, she now taught online and performed freelance website design, security, and maintenance. Three monitors and a laptop stared back at her. A cat rubbed on Lance's calves. The other feline ignored him from the windowsill. There was something different about his mom. Her eyes looked... she was wearing makeup. Lance covered his shock with a cough into his fist. He hadn't seen his mother wear makeup in... never. She waved him toward her. "Come here, I want you to meet someone." "Online?" Lance rounded the desk, set a hand on his mother's frail thin shoulder, and kissed her on the cheek. The skin stretched over the bones on her hands and was nearly translucent and streaked with blue veins. Years of chronic anxiety had aged her beyond chronological years. At 60, she looked much older, but her smile had brightened over the past few months. Today, he found her new happiness bittersweet. "This is Kevin Monroe." Her mom gestured toward her main computer monitor. On the screen, a gray-haired man of 60 or 70 waved.
"It's nice to meet you, Lance."
It's nice to meet you too."
Lance had seen him before when he'd dropped his mother at her weekly group therapy sessions. Therapy and visits to the psychiatrist were the only times his mom left her house. Kevin flushed and adjusted the collar of his plaid button-up shirt. The quiet in the room turned awkward and Lance realized this was probably the equivalent of a date for his mom and Kevin. Lance stepped back. He did not want to ruin this for her.
"I didn't mean to interrupt your conversation. I'll be in the kitchen. I need to talk to you when you're done."
"Kevin, I'll talk to you later," she said. Kevin responded with goodbye and his mother closed the computer window. She swiveled her chair to face Lance. Anxiety creased the corners of her eyes. "Did something happen to Morgan or Sharp?"
"No. Nothing like that."
Lance was bungling this.
"It's about Dad."
She flinched. "What?" Lance took a deep breath, crouched, and took both her hands in his.
"The sheriff's department pulled Dad's car from Gray Lake."
His mother's face went white, but she didn't flail or faint or throw a fit. Her expression was blank. Too emotionless. Was she even processing what he'd said?
"Are you sure?" "I saw the car myself."
He swallowed.
"It's Dad's."
She stared at their joined hands for a few seconds. When she looked up at him, her eyes were tentative.
"Was he inside?"
Lance hesitated. How much should he tell her?
"They think so."
"So, they're not 100% sure it's Vic."
Her voice dropped to a whisper when she said his father's name.
No, but identifying him shouldn't take long. Dad's dental records are on file.
Lance rubbed her fingers with his thumbs.
Tell me what you're feeling.
I don't know, exactly.
Her forehead wrinkled.
On one hand, it's a surprise. After all these years, I never really expected to find out what happened. On the other, it's not. I knew something terrible had happened to him. He wouldn't have left us.
That's what I always thought, too.
Was it an accident?
A tear rolled down her cheek.
Did he drive off a bridge or something?
No. There are no bridges near where he was found. The car would have been driven or sent into the water from the bank.
Lance paused. Was she ready for this? Did he have a choice but to be honest with her? She was a very intelligent woman. If he didn't tell her, she'd find the details on her own.
I think someone killed him.
She pulled one hand free and covered her mouth. You're sure?
Not yet. The sheriff will investigate.
And so would Lance. She wiped tears from her cheeks, her face frozen in a tragic smile. I thought I was all cried out over your father. I guess not.
I'll stay here tonight.
Lance kept the essentials in his old bedroom in case of an emergency.
Will you be all right by yourself for a few hours tomorrow?
Lance, I don't want you to babysit me.
Mom,
he protested.
That's not...
No. Her voice was firm. I'm sorry. I know you only want to help, but you've spent your whole life taking care of me.
I don't mind.
I know you don't. A sad smile turned the corner of her mouth. How much did I tell you about the new counselor who's been running our group therapy session for the last 2 months?
You said she was pushy and you didn't like her.
At first, I didn't. I was used to the old one. He'd been running the group the same way for 12 years. Change is hard for me, and some of the things Dr. Blake is encouraging me to do are uncomfortable. She blushed. I've been meditating and doing yoga.
Meditation? Yoga? Is this even my mother?
I'm not fooling myself. I'm never going to be able to grocery shop or go to the movies or run errands like other people, but I can be more independent. I don't need to be mentally isolated even though I'm physically limited. It's a choice, not an inevitability. I can connect with people right here in my house.
Like Kevin,
Lance said. She nodded. You have a job to do, a life to live. Seeing you with Morgan has made me realize how selfish I've been.
You're not selfish.
She held up a hand. Like any patient with a chronic illness, I have to learn to manage it myself. She straightened her frail shoulders. I have to do it. She looked determined and as grounded as he'd ever seen her. Maybe she could gain some independence. But in the back of his mind, a little voice whispered if she failed, she'd lose all the progress, all the happiness she'd gained in the past few months. She reached up and touched his face. Lance, I don't want to be a burden on you. You've given up too much of your life for me already.
If you feel comfortable managing things yourself, I'm behind you all the way,
he said.
But I'm also here for you. What can I do to help?
Find out what really happened to your father. His mother dropped her hand and hugged her arms, rubbing her biceps as if she were freezing. I'd like to put this behind me. I know it's asking a lot of you. He was your father. Maybe you don't want to delve into his personal life.
I already intended to find Dad's killer.
Then do it. I'll be fine. Here. His mother pressed a fist to her mouth and sniffed. Her shoulders curled forward, her posture projecting the distress her words denied. Lowering her hand, she swallowed. We both loved him. But we need to move on. We need to put his death behind us.
All right,
Lance said. Tomorrow he'd start by claiming his father's remains. Chapter 7. John H. Rogers, Captain, U.S. Army, Iraq. November 14th, 1982. July 10th, 2015. Beloved husband and father. Morgan stared at the headstone. Half of her wanted to throw herself on John's grave. The other half wanted to run away as fast as possible in case the sadness she'd recently shed caught up with her again.
Where's Daddy?
3-year-old Sophie frowned up at Morgan.
You said he'd be here.
Sophie's misunderstanding added 50 pounds to Morgan's mood. I'm sorry, honey. Morgan searched for the right words. Did she tell her daughter that John was in a box 6 feet under the grass? Thinking of his body decaying in a box alone all that time, she shuddered. Her grief turned claustrophobic. She looked at the open sky. The brilliant and glorious blue seemed like a betrayal. As if the world should not be so beautiful without John in it. There should always be some tiny visible sign of misery to match the kernel permanently lodged in her heart. While she was determined to move on with her life, she would never forget. Coming here was like ripping the scab off a wound before the underlying scar tissue had formed. Daddy isn't here, Morgan said. This is his headstone. We put it here so we can remember him.
Daddy's dead.
Ava carried a white bakery box. At 6, Morgan's oldest was the only one of her children who remembered their father. Usually she used a know-it-all tone when she corrected her younger sisters, but today her brown eyes, so like John's, turned up to Morgan for confirmation. Ava had the best understanding of the concept of death. At least she knew that her father was never coming home. Yes, honey, Morgan said. That's right. The frigid wind blew across the open landscape. Its harshness was somehow soothing. Morgan spotted a pink hat on the grass. She picked it up and tugged it firmly over her 3-year-old's light brown braids.
Mommy,
Sophie said,
we need candles. It's too windy for candles,
Ava said. Frowning, Sophie plopped down on her knees in the cold grass.
We have to sing. You can't eat a birthday cake unless you sing.
5-year-old Mia tugged on Morgan's hand. Her serious brow crunched with deep thought. Morgan crouched and tucked a stray lock of hair under Mia's purple hat. Mia leaned close to her mother's ear and whispered,
Am I supposed to be sad?
Morgan blinked, trying to stem the sudden hot flood of tears in her eyes. She squinted against a morning sun that shone too brightly. The grief she'd had firmly under control stirred to fresh life, threatening to drag her down like a weighted vest.
You're sad, Mia said.
I'm a little sad, Morgan admitted, her throat tight. But you're supposed to feel however you feel. Mia swiped a sleeve under her nose. The cold had turned her nose and cheeks bright pink.
I'm not sad.
That's good. Morgan dug a tissue from her tote and handed it to Mia. Daddy wouldn't want you to be sad.
Mommy's not sad all the time, like she used to be.
Sophie plucked a blade of grass from the grave and spun it between her fingers. Where are your mittens? Morgan asked Sophie. Her youngest gave her a what mittens look.
When can we eat the cupcakes?
Right now. Morgan took the blanket from under her arm, spread it on the grass in front of John's headstone, and knelt on it. Tears blurred the rows upon rows of plain, pale markers. Sacrifice and heartbreak organized with military precision. It was all too neat, too perfect to represent the turmoil that each and every death had left in its wake. Lives destroyed, hearts shredded, worlds upended. She wanted a tornado to sweep them up, to smash and scatter them, to leave these identically shaped markers as broken as all the people left behind. A few rows away, an older couple bowed their heads over a grave. A gust of wind whipped dead leaves around their feet. The leaves tumbled across the otherwise perfectly groomed landscape, a reminder that there would always be things that couldn't be controlled. The girls gathered around her. Sophie took the lead, singing happy birthday. Despite her lisp, her voice was surprisingly strong and on key. The older couple turned and watched. The man reached for the woman's hand. Morgan could tell they were crying, even if she couldn't see them through her own tears. The cold ground seeped through the blanket and the knees of her jeans. The rest of her was numb. She took a deep breath and handed out cupcakes, but couldn't eat hers. This had been a mistake. She'd been doing so well for the past 2 months. But how could she have said no after Ava spotted John's birthday marked on Morgan's calendar? Grief swept through her like a fever, reminding her of the dark place where she'd been trapped until just a couple of months ago. She'd almost forgotten how exhausting it had been. It was no wonder she'd done so little for the 2 years following her husband's death. She forced herself to taste the icing. Sweetness burst on her tongue, bright and intense as the sunlight.
"Sophie has icing in her hair,"
Ava said in a disgusted voice. Morgan pulled a box of wet wipes from her tote. She handed them out to Ava and Mia, then turned to her youngest. A gob of blue was stuck in Sophie's braid. More icing smeared her nose and lips and hands. How had she gotten it on her shoe? Morgan pulled out another wipe and started mopping up icing. In the back of her head, she could hear John's laughter. Instead of cleaning Sophie up, he would have smashed a cupcake on his own face to make his daughter smile. John hadn't wanted Morgan to be sad either. The letter he'd left her had made that clear.
"Who's going to eat Daddy's cupcake?"
Sophie asked. "We'll take it home, to Grandpa," Morgan said. "Is everyone ready?" Three little heads nodded.
"I'm cold,"
Ava shuddered.
"Happy birthday, Daddy,"
Mia said. Ava and Sophie echoed their sister. Morgan returned the wipe container to her tote and collected their trash. She stood and placed her hand on the top of the grave marker. The stone was cold under her palm. "Happy birthday, John." She lifted her hand, then turned and led her daughters away from the grave. Today she would concentrate on all the things she was grateful for in her life. Her children, her family, and her second chance at love. She would be happy if it killed her. They trooped back to the minivan. Morgan spotted one blue mitten by the front tire. She scanned the parking area and crouched to check under the vehicle for its mate. Instead of a blue mitten, she saw a flat tire. The hairs on her neck waved in the wind. She turned in a slow circle but saw no one across the open landscape of the cemetery. Trees surrounded the fields, but still she felt eyes on her. Relax. She'd been paranoid since the sheriff had told her Tyler Green had been released. Being out on bail and with assault charges already pending, Tyler had every motivation to stay far away from her. "We have a flat tire, girls. Let's get you all in the van where it's warm. Then I'll deal with the tire." She secured the children in their car seats, set the parking brake, and blocked the wheels. By the time she freed the spare tire from its location and dragged it out from underneath the vehicle, she was sweating, mentally cursing car manufacturers everywhere, and promising to start working out. Loosening the lug nuts proved to be another job requiring muscle she sadly lacked. Once she had the spare in hand and the lug nuts loosened, changing the tire was a dirty job, but no big deal. After hefting the flat into the back of the van, she cleaned her hands with baby wipes and climbed into the driver's seat.
"I'm hungry,"
Sophie said. They'd left the house early and none of the girls had eaten much breakfast. She drove out of the cemetery. "Then let's find some food."
15 minutes later, she found a diner and the girls fueled up on pancakes. Still unsettled, Morgan stuck with coffee. Ava and Mia cleaned their plates. Even Sophie couldn't resist syrup-smothered pancakes. With the kids happy and full, Morgan led them back to the van and secured them in their safety seats. She climbed into the driver's seat and shut the door. She inserted the key into the ignition and caught a heavy metallic odor. Cold wetness soaked into her jeans. What the? Morgan put a hand under her butt. It came away covered in dark red. Blood? Her heart kick-started and she leaped from the van. The van interior was black, but she could see the stain now that she was looking for it. The entire seat was soaked in it. And now so was Morgan. Had she locked the car? She always did, but herding three small kids through a parking lot could make anyone forget.
Mommy? What's wrong?
Ava called from inside the van.
More car trouble, honey.
Morgan scanned the parking lot but saw no one. The lot was only a quarter full. The other cars appeared to be empty.
Let's go back inside and call Mac.
Morgan hustled the kids back inside. She whispered an explanation to the waitress who occupied the girls with crayons and paper while Morgan called the police and Mac.
Mac is on his way, Morgan said to the kids.
She kept one eye on the other patrons and another on the parking lot. She saw no sign of Tyler Green.
Do you want to go clean up?
The waitress asked. She would absolutely love nothing more than to peel her nasty jeans and sweater off and scrub her skin raw. But her own comfort took a back seat to her children's safety.
I'll wait. Thank you.
Morgan wasn't leaving her girls alone for a second. She hadn't imagined anything. She should have listened to her instincts. She'd bet that flat tire hadn't been an accident either. Someone was doing much more than following her. She was being stalked. Chapter 8. Lance parked his Jeep in front of the medical examiner's office in the county municipal complex. He had been to the ME's suite in his days on the police force, but this time his role was as a member of the victim's family. It was a new part for Lance and about as comfortable as a suit made of poison ivy. Inside, the smell of burned coffee in the waiting area didn't help his nausea. He gave his name to the receptionist.
Dr. Jenkins left a message on my phone asking me to stop by today.
The call had come while Lance had been in the shower. Stop by if you can. I have a few questions for you. Did that mean Frank needed more information to ID his dad's remains?
Dr. Jenkins is in autopsy suite 3, she said. He said you could go on in.
Lance swallowed. He'd hoped the ME would be in his office. He reminded himself that all he'd see would be bones. There would be no putrid smell, no rotting flesh, no bloated body. He couldn't be that bad or Frank wouldn't have invited him in, right? Right? But Dr. Frank Jenkins was not known for his interpersonal skills. Lance suited up in the antechamber. Gown, booties, gloves. He carried the plastic face shield. Damp things made his face sweat. He wouldn't put it on until he had to. He opened the door and hesitated at the threshold, sweating, even without the shield. The other tables were empty. For once, there were no bodies in sight. But the scents of formalin and decomp were permanent fixtures. The smells lay heavy in the air, coating the back of his throat and threatening to gag him.
Lance, come on back.
Frank waved him into the room.
I want to show you something.
Lance held his breath and waded in.
Let's get this done.
A sheet covered the stainless steel autopsy table. On it, a skeleton had been loosely assembled. Frank circled the table, his attention focused on the remains.
I had my assistant put the skeleton in order. Some of the small bones were missing, but we have a good number. Hopefully enough to get a positive ID. Hopefully.
Lance walked closer.
Then you haven't formally identified my father? No.
Frank looked up, his face confused. The light glinted off his face shield.
Didn't Sheriff King call you? He did not.
Frank muttered something that sounded like asshole under his breath.
I'm so sorry, Lance. I should have called you last night after I called Sheriff King. This isn't your father.
Wait. What? The blood left Lance's head, leaving dizziness in its absence.
Excuse me? It isn't your father.
Lance glanced at the skull. The jaw looked undamaged, most of the teeth present. He breathed through his mouth, but the taste of the autopsy suite only made him feel worse.
You have his dental records? I don't need dental records.
Frank gestured to the bones.
The skeleton is female.
Shock hit Lance like a cold slap.
Are you sure?
Frank arched an annoyed eyebrow. With a sigh of great patience, he motioned to the skeleton and shifted into lecture mode.
Number one, the overall size and thickness of the bones, especially the femur, humerus, and radius, suggest this is a female.
He moved down the table to the center of the skeleton.
Second, the female pelvis is wider than that of a male specimen. Lastly,
he pointed to the skull.
The skull and jawbone of this victim also suggest it is female.
Lance stared at the bones, trying to take it all in.
Are you sure all of these bones belong to the same victim?
Frank nodded.
We collected about 85% of the skeleton. Most of the missing ones are small, fingers, toes, vertebra, etc. The bones are consistent in size, and there are no duplicates that would suggest a second individual was in the trunk of that car.
The medical examiner stepped away from the table and lifted his face shield.
Bones don't lie, Lance. This is not your father.
A few seconds ticked by as Lance absorbed Frank's words.
Not my father.
Those were the last words he'd expected to hear from the medical examiner.
Now what?
Someone put a woman in the back of his father's car and sent it into the lake.
Who? Why? Shit. Where's my father?
His visit with Frank was supposed to answer questions, not generate a dozen new ones. Hayne thumped at Lance's temples. He'd wanted to visit the ME on an empty stomach. Obvious reasons. But now his hollow gut churned.
You don't know who she is?
Lance asked. This unidentified woman was now the key to his father's disappearance.
No,
Frank said.
Not yet. We'll start with any local girls who went missing in 1994 and work from there.
Lance's ears rang. His gaze swept over the skeleton, suddenly seeing its feminine slightness.
Can you tell me anything about her?
Frank consulted a clipboard.
Measurement of the femur tells me she was approximately 5 feet 5 inches tall, give or take an inch. Any idea how old she was?
Frank gestured toward a row of x-rays on a light board.
Impacted wisdom teeth. She was likely at least 18. The fact that she didn't have the teeth removed could also mean that she didn't have access to dental care.
Lance added.
Or she couldn't afford the procedure. Right.
Frank waved a hand over the skeleton.
Some, but not all, of her growth plates are closed. The clavicle, or collarbone, is the last bone to complete growth. The medial end is not fully fused, so she was under 30.
Frank picked up a magnifying glass to examine a rib bone.
The ends of the ribs change as people age. Based on the smoothness I see here, I'd estimate that she was in her early 20s. Any idea how she died? Yes.
Frank read from his clipboard, then set it down and returned to the table. He pointed to a U-shaped bone below the skull on the sheet.
The hyoid bone is fractured.
The hyoid bone was located in the middle of the neck, between the chin and the thyroid.
She was strangled,
Lance said.
Most likely.
Frank nodded.
We're lucky. That only happens in approximately one-third of strangulation deaths. She wasn't lucky.
Lance stared at the tiny, meaningful bone. So she was dead when she was put in the trunk?
It's possible to survive a fractured hyoid, but I hope she didn't.
Frank frowned.
Me too.
Lance shuddered. Being strangled would have been bad enough, but he couldn't imagine the alternative.
Do you remember anyone who meets her description in your father's life? Did your father have any female co-workers or friends that he was close with?
Frank was circling around the topic, but his line of thinking was obvious. Infidelity.
I don't know.
Lance did not want to think about his father cheating, but he searched his memories.
No, my parents had some friends, but they were all about the same age as my parents, in their mid-30s in 1994.
If you think of anyone this could be...
Frank waved a gloved hand over the skeleton.
Please, call me.
I will,
Lance said. Frank stripped off his gloves.
If she was a local, or someone filled out a missing person report, I should be able to identify her. If nothing pans out, I'll bring in a forensic anthropologist.
Good luck.
Lance left the autopsy suite. He tossed his PPEs in the appropriate bins on the way out. As he walked across the parking lot toward his Jeep, his gut knotted. Where was his father? Chapter 9. The wind whipped at Morgan's face as she crossed the parking lot from the diner to her minivan, where Mac was leaning into the open door of his SUV. Thanks, Mac. She rolled the top of the brown bag down. Inside were her blood-soaked, now crusty jeans. Mac had brought her a clean pair.
You're welcome.
Mac had transferred the girl's safety seats to his SUV and was securing them in the back seat.
It's a little tight, but we'll manage. What are you going to do with the van?
I called a tow truck. There was no way she was sitting in a pool of blood to drive it to a garage. Besides, she wanted a mechanic to give the van a thorough once-over in case some other damage had been done.
Whoever broke into your vehicle damaged the locks.
Mac tugged on a child safety seat. Morgan pressed a hand to her forehead. I didn't notice when I opened the van. Seemingly satisfied with the car seat's fit, Mac stepped away from the open SUV door.
That's because your fob still chirps when you press the button. But the locks don't work.
Sophie tugged on Morgan's hand.
Can we go soon?
Morgan squatted to her level. Yes. I just need to talk to the deputy for a couple of minutes. Stay right here, with Mac.
Okay.
Head low, Sophie turned back to Mac's car. She'd awoken early this morning and would fall asleep as soon as the vehicle was in motion. Morgan approached the deputy typing up the incident report in the front seat of his patrol car. He pointed with his pen toward the rapid stain identification kit sitting on a clipboard in the passenger seat. Only one red line appeared in the test window.
It's not human blood.
Some sort of animal blood, then? She glanced back at her van. Animal blood was less disturbing than human blood, but still creepy. The deputy got out of the car. Were you able to get the feed from the security cameras? She asked.
No, ma'am.
The deputy pointed toward the camera mounted on a street lamp.
The camera is covered in foam. From the smell of it, I suspect it's hornet spray.
Morgan walked to the pole and squinted up at the camera. She sniffed, catching the whiff of insecticide. Clever. You can shoot that from 20 feet away.
Yes, ma'am,
the deputy said.
It sticks real well, too, so it completely covered the lens. Maybe we'll get a hit on the fingerprints I took from your van.
Morgan expected the prints he'd found to be hers. Anyone smart enough to cover a surveillance camera with hornet foam wouldn't leave fingerprints. You'll check on Tyler Green's whereabouts? She asked.
I spoke to Sheriff King,
the deputy answered.
He said he'll bring Tyler in for a talk. A copy of the incident report will be available in a few days.
The deputy handed her a business card. Thank you. Morgan stowed the card in her tote and turned back to her family. The kids were hanging on Mac. Her sister had gotten lucky with him. He was a good man. The tow truck pulled into the lot and she stopped to issue the driver instructions. Then she checked the van for personal belongings before getting into Mac's SUV. Exhausted from the morning, she nearly fell asleep on the drive home. Once the kids were settled in the kitchen with Mac, Morgan took a shower and dressed in a suit. She needed to visit the courthouse later. But not even a hot shower and fresh clothes could completely wipe away the skeevy feeling. She took her handgun from its safe and fastened it to her belt before heading toward the office in her grandfather's Lincoln town car. What kind of person would pour animal blood in her van? She reminded herself that Tyler Green had beaten his wife, hidden from process servers, and tried to strangle Morgan. Filling her car seat with blood was hardly a stretch for him. A donut shop on 3rd Street caught her attention as she drove past. Thanks to her stalker, a simple visit to the cemetery had consumed her entire morning. It was almost lunchtime. Her crappy morning and a dull headache called for a sugar and caffeine fix. She went through the drive-thru, then continued on to the office. Juggling her coffee, the bakery bag in her tote, she unlocked the front door of Sharp Investigations. After the emotional storm of the morning, the quiet building was bliss. A general weariness nagged at her muscles. She went into her office, dropping off her briefcase and coat before checking out the kitchen. Empty. She settled behind her desk with her coffee at her elbow and opened the bakery bag. The scent of warm glazed donuts wafted to her nose. She sighed and ate the first one in 3 bites, washing it down with coffee. Fortified, she checked her email and took her time with her second donut. Footsteps in the hallway announced Sharp's arrival. He appeared in her doorway. Taking one look at him, she couldn't argue with the all-organic, mostly plant-based diet he attempted to foist on everyone around him. At 53, the only signs of Sharp's age were his short salt-and-pepper hair and the crow's feet gathered around his seen-it-all gray eyes. His lean runner's body wore jeans and an Oxford shirt better than most men half his age. He glanced at the white bag on her desk.
I'm not even gonna ask what you ate today.
That's probably best. Morgan licked the sugar from her fingertips.
You eat enough sugar to give an elephant diabetes.
His gaze lingered on her face, which was probably red and puffy.
Is everything all right?
Where to even start? It's John's birthday. She fought a tear as she told him about the morning. Now that the incident was over and her girls were safe at home with Mac, her self-control felt shaky. Or perhaps Sharp was right, and she needed to cut back on the caffeine. She thought about the third donut, but decided Sharp would probably have a stroke if she ate it in front of him. Also, he was probably right about the sugar making her feel worse. Her sugar high was fading, leaving her queasy. Whoever decided to suspend a spare tire underneath a vehicle should be flogged. And someone is harassing me. All in all, it was not the best of mornings. And she still wanted the donut.
I'm sorry,
he said.
You okay?
Yes, she said. As frightening as the morning's incidents were, now that I know there's a threat, I can take steps to protect my family. And the grief that had crushed her at the cemetery had ebbed. She would miss John forever. And she would always be sad that he'd been taken from her and the girls. At every milestone, those feelings would resurface. But they wouldn't suck her under again. She wouldn't, couldn't let them.
Do you want to go looking for Tyler Green?
Sharp asked, his gray eyes narrowing, suggesting he'd love nothing more. Morgan shook her head. We have no evidence that it's him, and he's smart enough to file a harassment suit if we follow him around. The sheriff's department will handle it, and either Mac or Stella will stay at the house when I'm not there, so family's covered. Sharp nodded.
And I want me, Lance, with you at all times until the stalker's caught.
All right. Morgan was independent, not stupid.
Have you heard from Lance?
Sharp asked. I called him early this morning. She updated Sharp on Jenny's condition. He intended to visit the ME first thing.
I'd like to set aside a chunk of time to review Victor Krueger's case with you. I've been chasing leads for more than 2 decades. I'd like some fresh eyes on it.
Yes, of course, Morgan said.
I'll make you a shake. It's lunchtime, you need some protein to balance out your stress and whatever crap you just put in your body.
Sharp left her office, still muttering as he walked down the hall.
I have no doubt you haven't eaten anything even remotely nutritious today.
Thanks. Morgan didn't bother to argue. He'd just blend her a shake anyway. She needed real food in her body, but she ate the third donut while he was out of the room. She drank more coffee and called out, Where's the file?
Lance's desk.
Sharp answered from the kitchen. A blender whirred as she went into Lance's office. His desk was the only piece of furniture in the room. The file was in the bottom drawer. Dust floated to her nose as she pulled it out. She carried it back to her office and set it on her desk. A few minutes later, Sharp set a gross-looking concoction by her elbow. She sipped. Pineapple and blueberry. Considering the color and what you put in them, I'm always surprised that these don't taste horrible.
You can't even taste the leafy greens.
Sharp's current obsession was organic sweet potato greens. He eased into the chair opposite her.
This is gonna be hard on Jenny and Lance, no matter what he says.
I know. She studied the man across from her. He rarely talked about his past other than his police career. Were you ever married, Sharp?
I was.
He said. Why did that surprise her? His gaze drifted to the window, his eyes pensive.
The marriage was a disaster from the beginning. I wanted kids, she didn't. She didn't like being married to a cop, I didn't want to be anything else. We got a divorce. I haven't talked to her since I signed the papers. The last I heard, she'd married and moved to Boston.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to pry.
It was a long time ago. I was a young man.
Sharp shook it off, but sadness clouded his eyes, as if he had deeper feelings about the breakup of his marriage than he was willing to admit. When did you split up?
February of 94,
Sharp said. 3 months before Vic Krueger had gone missing. Sharp must have been lonely. Morgan pictured him throwing himself into the investigation, taking an equally lonely child under his wing. Maybe his relationship with Lance hadn't been as one-sided as Morgan had thought.
Anyway, I never came close to marrying again.
Sharp patted the desk.
Enough about me. You can grill me about the rest of my life some other time.
Morgan stared at the file, thick and heavy with implications. Before they could begin, the front door opened and closed. Lance appeared in the doorway. He took one look at Morgan's face and asked,
What's wrong? Where's your van?
She told him about her morning. Anger flared in his eyes.
I'd like to go after Tyler myself.
The sheriff will handle him, she said. Sheriff King is a pain, but this kind of situation is what he lives for.
True. We can count on King to hassle Tyler.
Lance rounded her desk, leaned over, and hugged her.
I'm sorry you had such a horrible morning. I wish I'd been with you.
If he'd been with her, she doubted her stalker would have been so brazen. But a mother focused on her 3 small children was an easy target. You had enough to deal with this morning, Morgan said. Lance released her and straightened.
Did you see the ME?
Sharp asked.
I did.
Lance's jaw sawed back and forth.
I just came from his office. You're not going to believe this, but the remains aren't my father. What?
Sharp snapped upright.
Skeleton is female.
Lance's eyebrows lowered. Silence floated in the air like dust motes.
Female?
Was Lance glad the body wasn't his father, or upset about the questions the news raised?
Frank doesn't know who she is yet?
Sharp asked.
No.
Lance lifted troubled eyes.
I haven't told my mother. She took the idea of my father's remains being found better than I expected, but I don't know how she'll react when she finds out he's still missing. Plus, there's the obvious implication that Dad might have had some sort of relationship with this young woman.
Lance went to the second chair that faced Morgan's desk, dropped into it, and recapped his visit with his mother. It was typical of Lance to be more concerned about his mother when the news would affect him just as deeply. Sharp got up and went into the kitchen. A minute later, the blender whirred and he returned with another shake. He handed it to Lance. Lance took it with a sigh.
I'm not really hungry. You have a headache, and you probably didn't sleep well.
Sharp said.
The protein will help.
You know he's always right about these things. Morgan studied Lance's exhausted face. How did he feel about his father still being missing? Sharp nodded.
I am.
Lance drank. Lowering the glass, he swallowed and seemed to brace himself.
Let's get started. I want to get more information before I tell my mother. I don't want to keep throwing conflicting reports at her. The ME isn't in a rush to release any information to the press. He wants to identify the remains and notify the family first. His assistant was pulling missing person reports when I left.
Sharp bowed his head and wrapped a hand around the back of his neck.
Now what?
There was only one thing that would help Lance. An answer. Morgan opened the file on her desk. Now we start at the beginning. Chapter 10. Lance turned to the whiteboard mounted on the wall. The board was empty. But what would they find when they dug into the case? Whatever it was high time he faced the truth. Morgan offered Sharp the file, but he clearly didn't need it. He leaned back in his chair and started talking.
We know that Vic left his house at approximately 9 p.m. to go to the grocery store. When he hadn't returned at 11 o'clock, your mother called his closest friends, Dan Adams and Brian Leed, hoping one of them would help. Neither was at home. So she drove the route between the store and house in case Vic's car had broken down. When she didn't find him, she drove to PJ's sports bar where he sometimes hung out with Brian and Stan. She didn't see Brian or Stan there. No one had seen Vic.
Restless, Sharp got up and paced in front of the whiteboard.
Jenny called the police a little before midnight. A uniform drove out to the house and took the initial report. Victor had no concerning health conditions or mental limitations. There was no evidence that he was especially at risk, though staying out this late was out of character. The uniform filled out a missing person report and issued a BOLO alert for Victor Krueger and his 1984 Buick Century.
Sharp stopped pacing and faced the board. Picking up a marker, he began a timeline.
The patrol officer had hoped, reasonably, that Victor had simply stopped somewhere or taken a different route. Maybe his car had broken down. Those were the days before everyone had a cell phone attached to his or her body. People still used cash for transactions. There was no easy pass. It wasn't so unusual for someone to slip off the radar for an evening.
Sharp used magnets to affix an old photo of Victor Krueger and two other men onto the whiteboard. The three men stood in front of a baseball field. They wore amateur baseball uniforms with the logo for a local appliance store on their chests. Lance's heart squeezed as he stared at the wide grin on his father's face.
That picture must have been taken at a game.
Lance remembered sitting in the stands watching games. Memories of his dad teaching him to play flickered through his mind like a slideshow.
My dad loved baseball.
Who are the other men? Morgan asked. Lance pointed to the men in turn.
Brian Leed and Stan Adams, my dad's best friends.
After a short pause, Sharp continued.
I took over the case in the morning. The first thing I did was go to the grocery store and view the surveillance tapes. Vic never entered the store that night. His car never pulled into the lot. I made the rounds of gas stations and convenience stores, flashed a picture of Vic around, and checked security videos were available. No sign of him. Normally, an unexplained adult missing person case doesn't get a ton of manpower, but Mrs. Krueger was highly agitated. My caseload was relatively light, and I thought the disappearance warranted an investigation. Over the next few days, I visited locations Vic frequented. I called hospitals, morgues, police, and sheriff stations, checked bus and train stations, the airport. I interviewed his boss, co-workers, close friends.
All the notes are in the file, but everyone agreed that Vic would never have just left his family. The more people I talked to, the more I became convinced that Vic Krueger hadn't left town on his own. I searched the house and his office. It didn't appear that he had taken anything with him except his wallet and car keys. I'd investigated people who walked, ran, and weren't taken from their families. But in all my 25 years on the force, Victor was the only person to actually vanish without a trace. This isn't the city people usually return from a trip to the grocery store.
Lance studied the board, trying to remain objective. So far, none of the case details were shocking. Sharp's initial investigation had been by the book, but still, when the missing person was your dad, seeing his case laid out should have disturbed him. But Lance felt as distant as he had been in 1994. It hadn't felt real then either. But then his mother had used up all the emotions. Mentally, she'd crumbled quickly, leaving Lance to pick up the pieces. His life had felt like reassembling a shattered vase when he didn't have all the shards. No amount of glue could ever make it whole again. What else could he have done except vary his own reactions? So, where do we start? Morgan asked. Sharp shrugged.
I updated the file and missing person database over the years, but not since I retired. Unfortunately, we don't have access to the NCIC, but I'll have to assume that the sheriff will utilize that system to look for light crimes.
The National Crime Information Center was an FBI database, only available to law enforcement agencies, not private investigators. It seems to me that you covered Vic's disappearance, Sharp. Morgan scanned the board. So we should focus on the new piece of information.
The dead woman.
Lance got up and went into his office. He returned a minute later with his laptop.
We can start with Namos. If she was a local and a missing person report was filed, her information should have been entered into the system.
The National Missing and Unidentified Persons System was a Department of Justice database, accessible to law enforcement and the general public. It cross-referenced unidentified remains and outstanding missing persons across the country. Lance tried not to think about the odds of actually finding his father. More than 40,000 sets of remains were unidentified in the United States, scattered in a patchwork of over 2,000 coroners and medical examiners' offices across the country. Even with his father's DNA on file, it was possible his body had been found years ago. Namos didn't exist until 2009. Vic Krueger's remains could be sitting in a vault anywhere in the country, or they could have been buried or cremated long ago without being identified.
Focus on the task.
Lance typed,
In Namos, there are 236 females missing in the state of New York.
Sharp leaned on the board and crossed his arms.
They'll be listed in order of date last seen. Start with July through September, 1994. Then we'll whittle the list down by region. Four women were reported missing at that time.
Lance scrolled.
Two were local girls. Laura Dennis from Albany was 22 years old when she disappeared. She was last seen August 1st, 1994. Mary Fox went missing from Gray's Hollow. Her description says she was 64 inches tall and weighed 115 pounds. Local girl. Close enough in height to Frank's estimate of the skeleton.
Sharp said. Lance continued.
She was reported missing August 25th, but the file notes say she was last seen a week or two before. Though she lived with her mother and stepfather, her mother wasn't sure of the exact date she'd left. They'd had an argument, and it wasn't unusual for Mary to stay with a friend for a few days.
No one reported her missing for 2 weeks. Morgan made notes on her legal pad. That's horrible.
Who's listed as the investigating agency?
Sharp asked. Randolph County Sheriff's Department? Lance said. King wasn't the sheriff in 1994. Morgan's chair squeaked as she shifted back and crossed her legs.
No.
Sharp shook his head.
Bob O'Reilly was the sheriff back then. He dropped dead of a massive heart attack on the job in 2001. King was the chief deputy. He ran for office, won, and has been sheriff ever since.
Let me pull up the case report. Lance said, I'll print Mary's photo. The printer hummed and spit out a sheet of paper. Sharp retrieved it and fastened it to the board.